Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead here again to have another conversation with you about some of the stories that matter. And folks, as we go into this week, as we look to get everything started, there are a number of stories that are demanding our attention. And today, I'm going to have an opportunity to speak with Pulitzer Prize winning columnist Leonard Pitts and talk about some of those stories. We'll do that in the first hour. Additionally, we want to explore what it means to live in a democracy with you. Exactly what does a democracy look like to you when we're living at a time where they're mandating vaccines, they're mandating masks, they're doing it to protect the general welfare of the people of this great experiment called America? What does that mean, and how much space does the government have to tell us what to do? We can talk about that today. And then in the second hour, I'll be joined by Dan and Claudia Zanes, musicians who did a long series called the Quarantine Series. We're going to talk about the ways in which you use music to help you through these moments in history. We'll open up the phone lines to you, and we'll hear from you about what does it mean to brace for a rally coming up at the same time that we're living through a global pandemic. I'm joined now by Leonard Pitts Jr., an American commentator, a journalist, novelist, national syndicated columnist, and winner of the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for commentary. How are you, Leonard Pitts? Welcome back to the show.
I am good. How are you?
I'm fine. I haven't spoken to you in a while. A lot has happened, so we want to use this time to get caught up and to hear from you the ways in which you see and write about America. So why don't we start by taking an eagle's eye view. Last Thursday, okay, on the eve of the 20th anniversary of 9/11, which happened, of course, on Saturday, it was the eve of us recognizing that though we had been in Afghanistan for 20 years, we got out, and a lot of people are calling that a debacle. President Biden makes a statement where he's talking about mandating vaccines for up to 100 million Americans, those who work for the federal government, those who work in companies that have more than 100 employees, those who work for the D.C. Postal Service. Like, he is making a broad, sweeping mandate. Get vaccinated or have weekly tests, or if necessary, get fired from your job. I want to break that up into two pieces. One, I want to get some sense from you. Where are people resting on this idea of mandating this vaccine, which is to help us during this global pandemic?
Well, all the polls that I've seen say that a majority of Americans are supportive of the mandates. But I would add that, you know, I'm supportive of them too, but I would add that I think it's kind of pathetic that it's come to that, that you need somebody to force you to save or protect your own life. I think that's just a sign of how crazy the country has become these days. Nobody should have to force you to do this. But as for, you know, the people claiming, well, it's overreach by the government, that's kind of the silliest thing I've ever heard. You already need shots to go to school. You know, you need shots to, I went to Africa for the first time, I guess back in 2003 or four, and I needed $600 worth of shots, you know, just to be allowed to leave the country and go over there. So this whole idea that the government can't force you to take a shot is just really ridiculous on the face of it. The government can't force you to take a shot. They can force you to carry and pay for a license in your wallet to drive your car. They can force you, in my neighborhood, they can force you to cut your lawn if your lawn gets too long. You know, it's just, you know, there's a litany of things they can require you to do. So it's kind of silly to sort of, this is just a dumb hill to die on. But a lot of people have chosen to do that.
And they're absolutely dying on this hill. I mean, I think it's interesting that, that statement is more than just kind of a metaphor. People who are unvaccinated are actually dying at higher rates of COVID-19 right now. And we're watching, as I think across the South at this point, in one state, they had like 18,000 children in one day to test positive. And at this point, from the last month, up to 250,000 kids have tested positive. We understand that children under the age of 11 and under, cannot get vaccinated. But if they're around adults who are vaccinated, of course, it severely reduces their chance to contract COVID-19.
Yeah, and these are things, we shouldn't have to explain. This should not be an argument. I don't care what your politics are. I don't care where you live. I don't care about any of this stuff. But I think we've reached a point as Americans where we literally can't agree on anything. Everything is political. Saving your life is political, which is just amazing that we've fallen to that point.
I want to get your thoughts on Afghanistan, because quite a few people, commentators, were saying, well, maybe this whole push to announce this mandate for vaccines leading into 9/11 took what happened in Afghanistan a couple of weeks ago off the front page. Because effectively it did. We were talking about that. What are your thoughts and what are you seeing about people's response to what some are calling a debacle with American soldiers leaving Afghanistan?
Well, I think public opinion's probably been all over the place. My opinion is that, the pullout was a mess, and it seems to me could have been arranged in a better fashion. And I hate the idea that of us leaving behind to the mercy of the Taliban people that risk their lives to help and to support our mission there. But as for the idea of pulling out itself, I think that was a no-brainer. Whatever needed to be accomplished, if we couldn't accomplish it in 20 years with $2 trillion, then it's not going to be accomplished. If you got 20 years and $2 trillion and you don't get it done, you're not going to get it done in another 6 months or a year. That just doesn't compute to me. So I supported Biden's decision to pull the plug. I just think it could have been done in a smoother, more effective manner.
How is Joe Biden doing, in your opinion? The last time we talked, he was just getting ready to come into office. Here it is. He's done a lot of sweeping legislation. He really has used, as a number of presidents recently have used, the power of the executive order to begin to do the political work that they're setting out to do. But something you said on my show, you said you cannot run the government through executive order. At some point, you're going to need laws to be able to cement the type of changes that you want to have happen. But it does seem like, President Joe Biden is going the way of executive orders at this point.
I think he's doing about as well as can be expected. But, I stand by what I said. At some point, the Congress has to start functioning. The Congress has basically been frozen as sort of a non-functioning body for years. I can't even begin. I'm trying to remember the last time I thought Congress worked. And, I think I probably had hair at that time, so that's been a while.
Well, would you say that Obamacare is an example of Congress working? Because that got through.
It got through, but it got through on a party line vote because the Democrats, had all of the had just enough votes. If I recall correctly, they didn't even have a vote to spare. So they got something done. But as far as the normal give and take and horse trading of politics, the way it was when I was coming of age. I can't remember the last time I've seen that where people, Bush with No Child Left Behind or the which was bipartisan, or the run up to the wars, which I think was also bipartisan. But it's hard to recall much beyond that. That was actually a result of compromise and two sides putting their heads together and reasoning together and trying to get something done. That just doesn't happen anymore.
And so we're at this kind of stalemate. Now, what we're watching when you talk about non-functioning, maybe functioning by non-functioning, is what the Supreme Court did by their decision not to take up the case around Senate Bill 8. So I want to have you talk about that. I have your latest piece here, Shame on Texas, that you had out in the Salt Lake Tribune. And it's interesting because I also, my op-ed column for the Afro was all about SB 8 and SB 4. And so I just wanted to kind of explore this with you and get your feelings on that and kind of where do we go from here.
Well, there are a couple of things that are really baffling about that law. The first is that it's the Supreme Court deciding not to deal with it at all, that allowing it to go into effect in silence. The law is blatantly and intentionally unconstitutional. It blatantly, transgresses Roe v. Wade. No matter what you feel about abortion, as a Supreme Court justice or just as a normal human being, it seems to me the Supreme Court's obligation was to either take up the case and either overturn Roe v. Wade or defend Roe v. Wade. Say, wait a minute, you're in violation. But basically, what they did was to see a mugging and look the other way. You know, they didn't defend the victim. They didn't defend the mugger. They just looked the other way, and that, for the life of me, I can't understand that. And I wonder how many other, you know, transgressions of constitutional rights and freedoms they'll be willing to do the same for. You know, if the government comes and shuts down a newspaper, which is in violation of the First Amendment, will they look the other way? It's just a really bizarre stance for them to take. And then the other thing that's bizarre about the law, as I'm sure you know, is the fact that it has no enforcement mechanism for the police or for the government. Instead, it says that a woman can't have an abortion after 6 weeks, and that if she does, then any individual, somebody who's not even related to the case, not related to her, doesn't know anything about it, can sue everybody except her, can sue anyone who assisted her in getting that abortion. So if I drove the Uber to take her right to the clinic, then I'm on the hook for $10,000. And if I was the doctor who performed the service, I'm on the hook for $10,000. If I just gave her a loan because she needed the money, right, you know, to go and get this done, then I'm on the hook for $10,000. That is bizarre.
It is bizarre.
And, you know, that's crazy. And again, I wonder how the Supreme Court just sort of looked the other way on that.
It's interesting because when you hear this whole notion coming out of Texas, which, you know, Texas and their freedom, Texas and their rights, everything's just different in Texas, that on one hand they're saying, let's protect the babies. It's all about the unborn children. But as you note in your op-ed, this is the same state that has recorded 3.6 million cases of disease and over 57,000 deaths, and they have spiked 107% in the last 14 days since, you know, September 1st. I'm trying to figure out how they say these two things at the same time when they are actually contradictory.
Well, if you're looking for logic, you're looking in all you're looking in the wrong places, because there's not a lot of that going around. The whole thing about being pro-life, I've heard a lot of people say recently, and I think it's very accurate, they're not so much pro-life as they are pro-birth. Yeah. And then after birth happens, and they don't really care too much about you. You can go to school and get shot up, and they call that freedom. You can go to school and catch the COVID, because mask mandates and vaccine mandates are struck down, and they call that freedom. I mean, it's just a bizarre state of affairs that they're doing. This is what happens when extremists get to run things, yeah, with people who have no sense of proportion, people who have no ability to make human judgments. That's what happens when they get to run things. You get all of this insane stuff, and this stuff is going to be with us for a minute. It's going to be a while unraveling all of this, if we ever do.
This is what's interesting, and I was speaking with Leonard Pitts. What's interesting to me is that I feel like we have reached a point in this country where if you're trying to make sense of anything.
I'm losing you a little bit there.
Oh, okay. So can you hear me better now?
Yes.
Okay. So I feel like we've reached a point in this country where making sense is not part of the equation. And that's from Washington, D.C. on out. Nothing, as we look across this nation, is making sense. Not SB 8, Senate Bill 8, Senate Bill 4, which means you cannot, after 7 weeks, a doctor can't prescribe the morning after pill. The mask mandates, the mandate restrictions, vaccine requirements, the variants, schools are wide open, soccer and football stadiums are filled. So it's not just those that are extremists who are running things, it's people allowing them to make decisions that don't make sense.
Yeah, well, I think the people who are running things are representative of a very angry, very vocal minority in this country that unfortunately vote out of all proportion to their numbers. And so, you know, they tend to wield disproportionate power over the rest of us. But the people who are running things, they didn't just spring out of nowhere. They were voted into power to be exactly what they're being and to do exactly what they're doing. So, yeah, we can look at the leaders and the congresspersons and the governor and whatever and the Supreme Court, but we also got to look at our neighbors who sort of went along with this, either went along with it actively or went along with it passively by not voting or by refusing to vote or by buying into the lie that there's no difference between one politician and another. You know, there's a lot of different ways in which we have sort of been the architects of this moment that we're living in. And the question for me is, are enough of us who see the danger going to wake up and do what needs to be done? You know, we had a record turnout for the last election, the presidential election, and that was great, and it got rid of you know, the guy who was in office. But the thing I wonder is, will those people who turned out in record numbers last year, do they understand that you have to keep doing this? It's not a one-time shot. Politics is not a spectator thing where you can just sort of, you know, set it and forget it. It's something right. where you've got to be engaged every time, every election. That's how the other people have gained power. That's how they took over the school boards, and that's how they took, you know, they started with small offices. That's how they took over the school boards and the county councils and the, you know, the mayor's offices and all of this stuff. And you know, because they're engaged every time. And the reason that they're able to be engaged every time is because they're motivated by fear. They have this fear that and it's promoted in them that somebody's coming to get you, somebody's coming to take something from you. You know, that's and fear is a very effective thing. And I think that those of us who are on the other side need to figure out what are our motivating triggers. Right now I have fear that, you know, we're going to see more of what we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years at the federal level. I think, you know, Biden is trying to turn it around, but my fear is that we're going to see more of this, that we're just sort of living through an interlude, and then, you know, he who was in office from 2017 to 2021 will either return or one of his clones will take over, and that I find terribly frightening.
I find that to be frightening as well. When we talk about those of us who showed up in record numbers to get that person out of office, it seems like we get lulled into complacency very easily. We show
yes,
up and we're passionate. It's like, we've got to get President Barack Obama in office. Okay, but then we didn't show up for the midterm elections to give President Obama the support he needed to get things done. And right. that really is my fear, that people don't understand that democracy is something you actually have to keep fighting for. You can't trust that you can right the ship and then we'll just go forward with that going from this point on. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah. And like I said, they want to set it and forget it. And, you know, that it doesn't work that way. You have to be an engaged a member of this society, or else you can count on the fact that people who do not have your best interest at heart are going to have power over you, is the bottom line.
What's at stake in this next election, these midterm elections?
Oh, my goodness. Among the many things that are at stake is our right as African Americans, our continued right to vote, which is in danger and under threat like it hasn't been in 56 years, I guess it is. So to me, that's the number one thing. Then, of course, there's there's the planet itself. We tend to forget that while we're talking about all of our sort of things that are going on in our lives inside of our country, the planet is going crazy, and we are starting to see, you know, the results of all those dire predictions that we heard back in the 2000s and the 2010s. A lot of that stuff is coming true before our very eyes. It seems like, you know, every year is the hottest year on record, and we got wildfires like we've never had before. We've got hurricanes in places that we've never had before, and tornadoes and drought. There's, you know, the Colorado River is drying up in the Southwest, and, you know, what's Los Angeles going to drink? And on and on and on. And this is just in our country. So, you know, that's on the ballot. This is true of every election, but I think never more critically than in this election, the future is on the ballot. And the question of whether or not we're going to have one is that's what's on the ballot.
You did a piece that came out September 1st. Right-wing radicals have stated their aims. We better believe them.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about their aims? We know if January 6th is any indication, part of it is it's not just about putting the former president back in office. It is about reclaiming something by force if necessary. I mean, we're now thinking of the real implications of what would have happened if they had caught Nancy Pelosi or Mike Pence. I mean, Mike Pence is from on their side. At that time, they were saying things like, hang Mike Pence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm sorry. What was your question?
Just
was
to, just to talk about what are their aims from where you sit?
Their aims are to impose a sort of this radical vision of America, a sort of quasi, sort of like the American version of the Taliban, except Christian. The American version of what you had in Iran with the mullahs, except Christian. Their aim is to impose a theocracy, but it's a theocracy that sort of adheres to their bizarre version of what faith means and what the Constitution means and what democracy means. They, you know, it's this sort of bizarro world view that they are intent on imposing upon the rest of us. It's one thing for people to live in an alternate reality, and you look at them and say, "Oh, that's pathetic," but that's them living over there. But it's another thing for them to take power and then make that alternate reality your reality, so that you have to live there too. Okay, and that's what they're seeking to do. For them, it's an article of faith, for example, that the last election was stolen. They can never provide any kind of proof, but if you listen to these people, it's an article of faith that it was. It's an article of faith for them that Ashley Babbitt, the Capitol rioter who was killed by a police trying to break in to where members of the House were sheltered, is some sort of hero and a victim of a police overreach. Now, you know, Trayvon Martin, oh, he was guilty. Mike Brown, oh, he deserved what he got. You know, on and on. Breonna Taylor, she deserved what she got. But this woman who has broken into the Capitol and is trying to break a window to get to lawmakers, she's an innocent victim. You know, so it's this insanity, this craziness, but it has gone unchallenged for so long that it's sort of grown and metastasized. It went unchallenged. It still goes unchallenged, frankly, by the Republicans because it helped them. It gave their party energy. It went unchallenged by a lot of us in this country, particularly white people in this country, because it was white and therefore somehow harmless or innocent. And now it has reached the point where I've been talking for a long time about where the future of if the future of the country can be secured, if there's going to be an America. And people would always say, well, do you mean there's going to be a civil war? And it was kind of hard to get a vision of that. But I've been telling people the last few weeks, I would not be surprised to see people with MAGA hats start doing random shootings and bombings in this country. And I'm deadly serious about that. I'm deadly serious because, that to me is the next step. You're not going to have armies like you had in 1861. Right. You're not going to have the Army of Virginia going up against the U.S. Army. That's just not, I don't see that happening. But I can see people standing up, in buses where, in the Middle East, they stand up and they go Allahu Akbar and they, do the explosives or whatever. I could see somebody doing that in the shopping mall, saying, make America great again, and blowing themselves or somebody else's smithereens. I can absolutely see that. So, there's a lot at stake here. And it's like, if we're not serious about saving this country, then we won't. Bottom line.
Is democracy dead in this country? We often talk about democracy. I think people sometimes don't even understand. They're like, we live in a democracy. Well, really, it's more of a democratic republic. I'm not sure if you know what a democracy is or if we even know if we've ever experienced a democracy. But has it died?
Democracy is supposed to be, representative government, one person, one vote. I don't think it's dead, but I think it smells funny. We'll put it like that. It's not dead, but it's starting to smell funny. You know, fascism is on the rise, which is the other thing that those people are fascinated by. They want, the whole idea of fascism is that one person, one strong man, usually it's almost always a strong man, will fix it. That was Hitler, that was Pol Pot, that was Mussolini. And that was, the last president. It's sort of this whole idea of a strong man who is not answerable to government rules and regulations. It tells us something that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the last days of the last regime was planning for how to resist a coup from the president. I mean, just think about that for a minute. You know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and his colleagues were planning how they were going to resist a coup from the president of the United States. if that doesn't chill you and make you, you know, concerned about what time it is in this country, nothing will.
Well, here's the thing I think is interesting is that we were so concerned if we just get that person, get Trump out of office, then everything will be okay. And then that's not the case. I think a lot was lost. A lot of ground was lost under that president that we have not regained.
I never thought it would be a thing of everything would magically be okay. I thought it would be a great first step. But, you know, you've got to remember that, you know, Trump was never the cause of the illness. He was the symptom. So, you know, once you've gotten rid of this symptom, or at least you've got this symptom walled off, you still got to deal with the cause of the illness. And the cause of the illness is the fact that this country is undergoing seismic demographic change, where white people will no longer be the majority in this country. Nobody will be the majority in about 20 years, I think it is. Everybody in the country is going to be a racial minority. And I've been saying this, you know, over and over. I think I've spoken it to you. Many of them are not finding that an easy transition to make.
Right.
And, you know, they've done study after study showing this, that the great driver in the election of Donald Trump was the fact that a lot of white people feared, as Tucker Carlson puts it, that they're going to be replaced by black people, by Hispanic people, by Asian people, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's this fear that the straight white Christian is under assault and is going to be replaced. And so, you know, until we are able to figure out a way to manage that fear among a certain segment of white American, white America, then we're destined to continue having these upheavals.
Leonard Pitts, it has been.
I always depress you, Donna.
I know. I mean, every time I talk to you, it's like, okay, I always have to take a breather because it's the idea that it's worth fighting for.
I don't know why you keep asking me to come on.
I love it.
I feel so guilty.
I love having intellectual talk, but you get us fired up. You get us fired up. As you said, it's worth fighting for. Leonard Pitts, American commentator, journalist, novelist, nationally syndicated columnist, winner of the 2004 Pulitzer Prize for commentary, and a personal friend of Today with Dr. K. So thank you so much for coming on, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So, folks, when we come back, I want to talk to you about what Leonard Pitts just put on the table. Has democracy died? Is it worth fighting for? What does it look like to you? 410-319-8888. We'll take your calls after the break. With Dr. K, I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Democracy is what is on the ballot when the midterm elections come up. We are in a fight to save this country from itself at this point. It's not as if we can point to any one person or any one thing. It was not just about getting the former president out of office. Democracy itself is on the ballot for the upcoming midterm elections. I want to hear from you. So how do we save democracy? Maybe from where you sit, democracy's not being challenged. There's nothing wrong. Everything is going well. I don't know. There are a number of people who would beg to differ with you and who feel like right now what we're going to have to do is we've got to find a way to save democracy. I am not sure how we do that. I think that one piece of it is we have to get up and vote. We have to vote. We have to understand what we need to do and how we can move forward from this point on. Democracy, one vote for one person, is on the ballot again. I am not sure what democracy even looks like. In this country that has struggled for so long, I'm not even sure if we can ever achieve democracy. Not yet. I want to hear from you. 410-319-8888. I have Jeff on the line from Pasadena. Jeff, how are you?
Good afternoon, Dr. K. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for calling.
I wish you would have kept the guest on. I wanted to talk to him, ask him some questions. Mm-hmm. as a proud Trump supporter. He was talking about logic, saying, well, if you're looking for logic in the state of Texas, you're not going to find it, or something like that. I have a question for Trump haters out there. It's the Trump haters who support abortion but oppose the death penalty. Where is the logic in killing innocent unborn babies but keeping cold-blooded murderers alive and giving them medical care and three meals a day out of the working people's tax dollars? Where's the logic in that?
I have a question for you. I'm so glad I put that on the table, so we want to open that up for people. And I have a question for you. I'm assuming you said you're a Trump supporter. How you said that, assuming Trump supporters are against abortion, how are you against abortion? And you want to protect... No, let me ask the question because I'll let you ask yours. And you want to protect life, yet you are okay with people carrying guns without permits that then end up with more mass shootings this year that are up by 65%. So you can ban what happens with my body, but you don't want to ban the right to carry a gun.
Just arrested a guy today because he had a knife and a machete in his trunk. Mm-hmm. Are they going to arrest people if they go to a store and buy a box of knives and are driving home and they get pulled over and the officer sees knives in the car? This is getting insane.
Another thing I want to ask. You didn't answer the question, because if I get a knife and I take a knife out of the machete, I'm cutting one person at a time. I'm talking about AR guns. I'm talking about weapons of mass destruction. When you talk about in the hands of one person, that could potentially kill or wound dozens of people. So I want to talk about that, not necessarily the machete. It's not really about a machete, right? We're not talking about one person with one knife. We're talking about having these mass weapons, taking them into places and committing atrocious acts against innocent people and children, because we have mass shootings at school as well.
What percentage of gun-carrying people are committing these acts? You act like we're hearing about this stuff every day.
You brought it up. You wanted to know.
Abortion
and the death penalty. You put those two things on the table as dichotomies. I said, okay, well, if you're going to put on abortion and the death penalty, then I have questions about abortion and gun control. I'm only putting the dichotomy up to meet the one that you put on the table.
How often do we see these acts? What we do see every night is blacks killing other blacks.
Okay, wait a minute. Now we're going into the race issue. You put abortion and death penalty on the table. How often do we see that? I put up abortion and gun control. Mass shootings are up 65% this year. They are. And we're talking about places with what happened in Texas with Senate Bill 8 and Senate Bill 4 in a place that allows people to have the constitutional right of carry where you have more mass shootings. Jeff?
Of Texas, vote for Democrats and they can overturn it. Every state should be allowed to determine what they want to do. But I want to ask another thing about logic.
Okay.
It's the Trump-hating liberals who say the more we overpopulate the planet, the worse global warming will be.
Okay.
So where's the logic in giving money to women having a bunch of kids by a bunch of different guys?
Okay, so now we're back into that. Now let me just—I want to just kind of break this up because you keep going the Trump hating. Let's understand that people had a problem with these issues before Trump. Trump is not the savior nor the center of the root of the problem. You keep saying Trump haters, Trump love. If we can just remove Trumplicans from the equation and talk about the issue. So you also have a problem with giving financial support to women through assistance programs for women who are receiving money when they don't have enough financial wherewithal, financial ability to take care of their families. We understand that the highest percentage of people right now receiving government assistance with babies is white women. So now you want to, so don't start bringing in race about having babies, because men are also responsible. Women do not get pregnant by themselves. We should also be holding men, many of whom are Republicans, also responsible for this. Not just women having a bunch of babies off by themselves. They don't have babies by themselves, Jeff.
Well, where are the guys at? The guys should be taking care of them.
And now we agree on something. I absolutely agree with you, Jeff.
And you said something last week that I kind of agree with.
Oh, good.
Okay, I got a thing where this mandate, make this mandatory, make that mandatory. I think when a woman has her third kid by a third different guy, doesn't matter about skin color, she has to go in the hospital and get the operation and not have any more kids. But I also agree with you. We should start looking at these guys. If a guy goes out and makes three kids by three different women, maybe cut you-know-what off, or what you were saying.
Now,
I agree.
Okay, I do agree with that. I want to break that up because I don't people walking away. I am not saying that we should be castrating men. I said the vasectomy. And if I'm not mistaken, again, I don't know the ins and outs of vasectomy, but vasectomy does not involve castration. In fact, vasectomy is a very simple operation that can actually be reversed. And I was talking about, should we, instead of controlling what happens with a woman's body, should we look to instead impose those type of rules and restrictions on men and boys? It was to foster conversation, Jeff. Now, castration is another different thing. And I think castration is part of a conversation if we're talking about people who are rapists and pedophiles. That's a different conversation. But when we're talking about having children, I didn't say castration. I talked about vasectomies.
Either one. I'm okay with either one if it'll get the job done, if it'll keep guys from making a bunch of kids but with a bunch of different women. But as far as this women's thing and their choice, well, I have not been sick over the last 2 years from the virus. I shouldn't have to get something I might have natural bodies to. Now, if we want to make it mandatory for people to get the vaccine because they might infect somebody else, why don't we make it mandatory when people leave a bar every night they have to get a breathalyzer?
Oh, you know what? I'm going to say with the number of drunk driving incidences, with road rage on the rise, with the fact that we're seeing more car accidents, maybe we need to have a little bit more mandate and control over that. But I do want to wait and step back and listen to other callers. Well, and the straw man circular logic, well, if I don't do this, I shouldn't do this. I think we piece each one of those things out. I think we start talking about mandating vaccines as a way of protecting public health, laid out by the preamble to the Constitution to protect the general welfare. I think it does lend itself to a different conversation.
I'm going to leave it at this because I know you got other
callers. We have a lot of other calls.
There are more people. There's a better chance of somebody getting hit by a drunk driver than there is a vaccinated person catching the virus from an unvaccinated person and dying. There's a much better chance.
But I want to note, Jeff, just in the last month alone, over 250,000 children have tested positive for COVID-19 in states where vaccination rates are very low. So to pull out the drunk man, to pull out the vaccine, I'm saying get vaccinated when it talks about protecting children. Does anyone, particularly people who are saying, no, I'm not for abortion. Well, if you're not for abortion and you don't mind that children are going to school, they're unvaccinated, and they can get COVID-19, I need to understand, is it really about the children or is it about controlling a woman's body and a woman's right to choose? Jeff from Pasadena, I appreciate you. We have John, Clarence, Gene, and Curtis. Let's go to John next. How are you?
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for calling.
Dr. K, you are a much better person than I am. I do not waste my time trying to have a logical discussion with a hardcore Trump supporter. You're not going to sway any of them by facts and logic. That's something that they don't accept. Now, when you talk about a democratic form of government, you know for yourself that the great Greek thinkers, Plato and Socrates, Aristotle, they thought that they frowned upon that. You know, they felt that the masses are not smart enough or intelligent enough to participate in decision making, and they lean more toward an oligarch form of government. And you look at the founders of this country when they set it up, when they talked about democratic form of government, what they were talking about is a government where only white individuals with property would participate in.
Yes.
Now, you know, there's something that we strive for, and, you know, it's not a great form, but it's about the best form of a government that I know of. And it's really not pure, you know, I mean, it's a democratic republic. And that's all I have to say, but you are a better person than I am.
Well, I want to say, John, before you go, I was thinking about what you said. I mean, when you put Plato and Socrates on the table with democracy, two things came to mind. One is something that Winston Churchill once said about democracy when he said, no one pretends that democracy is perfect or all wise. Indeed, it has been said that democracy is the worst form of government except all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. Winston Churchill said, you know, democracy is the worst, except everything else is much worse than democracy. And this is where we find ourselves. And then I think of the Thomas Jefferson quote when he says that, you know, that people who want to have their freedom and be ignorant, they want something that never has been and never will be. You can't you know, rest in ignorance and say you want your freedom. The two things don't work in the same space.
And the way the Republican Party now defines democracy is anybody who votes against them, you know, is not intelligent enough to participate in the process. That's why you have all this voter suppression.
It's very scary.
And
it's
if the outcome doesn't favor them, then there's fraud. So that's the logic they use now. If they don't win, it's because of widespread fraud. So thank you for giving me a little time.
Thank you so much, John. We have Clarence, Gene, and Curtis on the line. Let's go to Curtis next. Curtis, how are you?
Okay, how you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
So I really appreciate both of your last callers. I really like Jeff, Dr. K.
Yeah.
Just, you know, no, not being sarcastic.
No, I do too. I like when you have
it's
opposing
really,
viewpoints.
I like people like Jeff, the Trump supporters and all. I love talking to them, Dr. K, because, you know, on the other side of what John said about persuading someone to see reality or deal reality, there's a good possibility when you can have a dialogue with them that, you know, that person says, hey, you know what, this is like this. And then on the other hand, when John said that, you know, when the founding fathers set up this system in America, that it was only for white people with property,
white men.
I was hoping that other white people or so-called white people would hear those words. You understand what I'm saying? Because when you really look at the whole situation in this country, what I see, Dr. K, is bad leadership all the way around, from local government to federal government, Dr. K, on both sides, not just one, not just the Republican Party. I see bad leadership all the way around. And I think that until we get some people in our local government, state governments, and in our federal government that's up with reality or live in reality, we can't really change anything. So voting is really important, and who we put in office is really important. So everyone must vote.
Thank you, Dr. K.
I
agree. But let me just say this, Curtis. Everyone must vote. And can I add, if I may, everyone is also called upon to do as much work as they can so they can vote with a conscience. They can vote with education on their side, that they can vote and understand the issues that are at hand rather than voting for the names that they've heard before.
Absolutely, Dr. K. And one more thing, and I'm going to be gone, Dr. K. I was listening to C-SPAN the other morning last week sometime, and a gentleman called in with an opinion. And he said, well, I don't vote, but this is how I feel. Listen up, people that don't vote. If you don't vote, you don't have an opinion.
Thank you, Dr. K. Okay, I'm saying you do have an opinion. It may not be a well-informed opinion. How's that? Because they do. I know people don't vote who have a lot of opinions. I'm like, you know, those opinions aren't well-informed. You got an opinion. My dad said everybody has an opinion.
Okay, all right, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, they have one. It just doesn't work for the way in which we're trying to turn this country around.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. K.
Thank you so much, Curtis. I appreciate you. Let's go to Clarence next, and then we'll hit Gene.
Dr. K, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Thanks for calling, Clarence.
Dr. K, you somehow, when you phrase the question of can we save democracy and saving democracy, as if black survival will be depending upon whether democracy exists in one form, shape, or form or another. Well, you know, you can go out and vote and do what you need to sustain the democracy, but that black survival is not dependent on it. The democracy did not save Sandra Bland or save Trayvon Martin or any of this or the next black person who may or may not get shot. And so, you know, black survival and saving democracy need to be not intertwined as one and the same, okay? That's just how I feel about that. But, Dr. K, you know, I have to respond to something, you know, and you may frown upon this, but, you know, but the social construct that allows for poverty, inequality, birth, you know, children born out of wedlock and are subjected to those social conditions, you know, maybe
that is needed, and abortion is not wanted, because we need those numbers for cannon fire, so that there will be no other choice out to go but to go into the military, where the Donald Trump Juniors will not serve in the absence of the draft. Maybe, just maybe, and I'm not saying this, Dr. K, but this is a thought. Maybe I'll support abortion when you bring back the draft. Okay, I'm just saying that, Dr. K. I don't really mean it, but, you know, some people have just, okay.
So, I mean, some people are very passionate when they come to this. But here's my question for you, Clarence.
No, I would never support abortion, though.
I get what you're saying. I get what you're saying. But let me ask you this, because I think we should put a couple of different perspectives on the table, right?
Yeah.
So you have this whole idea of pro-birth, which we know is different from pro-life, right? Because you're not talking about taking care of the baby all the way through. You just don't want women to have abortions. You have, you know, being pro-abortion and then pro-choice.
Yes.
I am, very clearly, I'm not telling my stance on abortion. I am pro-choice. I think people have a right to choose what happens to their body. And women should have the right to choose what happens with their body. What is so wrong with women being able to make that choice?
Absolutely nothing, because that is their choice.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that zygote at its conception, when it happens, that individual zygote is life. When you want to break it down and go to that level, sure, it doesn't have two arms and two legs and 10 fingers and 10 toes, but it is still life. So therefore, I cannot in good conscience, as a human being that has a love for life and also as a love, you know, support women and having the right, Dr. K, I cannot, you know, it's one of those things where it's above my pay grade.
Okay.
You know, if you get my drift, I hope that doesn't offend anybody, but, you know, everything, okay, let's leave it there.
No, I like that you're leaving it there. I do say, in terms of above your pay grade, the unfortunate thing, Clarence, is that you can admit that, except in places like Texas and soon South Dakota, Mississippi, Tennessee, Florida, you have men sitting and saying it's not above their pay grade. They do have the right to actually put women's lives in danger by deputizing any old Joe Schmo citizen with a gun to go and do the work.
And I would think that even if the Supreme Court turned their head and didn't want to deal with it, that still, even on a level lower than the Supreme Court, that is unenforceable. I just can't.
I agree. I just think it's the problem is that the Supreme Court, when they made the decision not to make a peep, not to make a noise, by their silence, they were being complicit, and
which I believe is the subterfuge in the whole scenario, because the Supreme Court is going to wait till somebody presents a legal challenge to that law, and then they can rule on it in favor of overturning Roe versus Wade. I think they're waiting for the case to come up, you know, like they did in the issue of affirmative action. They were just waiting for the right case to come up. Okay, the right challenge where they could make a ruling on. So I think that's what absence right now or silence right now means. Okay, we'll rule on this when the right challenge comes up that we can impose our political views or our ideologies on the rest of the country. That's what I think is happening there. But thank you for
thank
the call,
Thank you so much,
Dr.
Clarence.
K.
I appreciate you. We have Tony on the line from Baltimore. Tony, how are you?
Just was listening. I had to call in.
Thank you.
First and foremost, this has never been a democracy. We're in modern-day Babylon, and it's falling, you know, as we live and as we live our lives as Africans in America in this country. So the whole thing of saving something that never existed cannot happen. So this country was not, like you stated before, it was about ownership, white men and ownership, et cetera. Yeah. And so now where we're at the precipice now, this country's falling apart. Everything's being exposed for what it was built on, which was racism, lies, and hatred. And so as black people, we need to realize what is our plan from rising from the ashes, because this will fall. Anything unrighteous only has so much of time. And then I wanted to respond to something that one of your callers said at another, because I think this level of ignorance when it comes to voting is beyond my belief. First of all, you're not obligated to choose between a lesser of two evils. If you're hungry and I offer you feces and urine as a choice, neither one of them are palatable. So therefore, this whole notion of you don't have a right if you don't vote, first and foremost, as far as whites, I'll speak on whites because this always goes to Africans because I understand our conditions of psychological slavery. 5% controls pretty much around 80-90% of the wealth. They are the ones who select. This is an oligarchic system. So they're placing these individuals. So when the guy that called in earlier talking about, oh, if you don't vote, you don't have an opinion. Hold up. I can have an opinion, and I can have a say-so in the society and in community and don't have to ever vote because I can be in a position, if I'm in that 5%, to decide the individuals when they feel as though the masses, when they feel as though the masses are not capable of making informed decisions, a la the caller that just called in prior with the Trumpican type of thought process. That level of ignorance and racism, you're not going to talk away. You're not going to logically get them to see because they're working on, as Francis Cress Wilson said, they're talking about genetic survival. Yes. So they're playing chess, and we're still playing checkers because they're making all kinds of moves when it comes to population control, all of these things. And we're still hooked on this. Our ancestors died for the right to vote. No, our ancestors were denied their natural giving rights to participate in a society. Now, you have the right to choose whether or not you want to participate. Now, you don't have the right to take that my choice away from me. So when people talk about, oh, no, I think everyone should have the right to vote. But that's your choice if you choose to participate on the level that you choose.
Okay, I got to stop you there, Tony. I appreciate you.
Which means nothing.
Now, folks, we got to take a quick break. We got to leave it here. When we come back, we're going to pick up this conversation on the other side. And I want to add another question to kind of complicate this discussion around the future of democracy. Gene from Pikesville, I see you holding on. We'll get you right after the break.